Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is August 19th, 2021 for like 15 more minutes. This is Radio Free Nintendo episode 736. I am James Jones. I'm joined today by the returning Guillaume Vaillette.
Good evening.
Good evening, Guillaume. Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be here, James.
It's great to be here, John. Last week you said that to Greg, too. So
yeah. He only gets 1 week of that.
Right.
One week of consideration.
I mean,
so the new normal is not to be like, hello, John, and then hello, Guillaume, and then hello, Greg, hello, Guillaume, and then.
Yeah, no, know. I want to do the multiplicity of greetings, is what I'm suggesting. The Cartesian products of hellos.
Yeah, this week it's not great to be here, Greg. Nothing in particular. Just, you know.
And what changed? Just the fact that I'm here? I get it. I see.
I can be moody sometimes, you know.
John is up to lunar rhythms, and he's very perceptive of
those. I'm a Gemini. I'm a Gemini, so, you know.
Yeah, so am I.
There you go.
Therefore, like one of us, there can be only one.
It can only be one. No. This is Guy's week to be happy.
I was going to cut off your head, but yeah, sure.
No.
Well, yeah, it makes you happy. Of course you would.
Isn't Gemini a okay, all right. You know what? No, I'm not going to go there.
Gemini's the duality of man. Come on.
Okay. I'm going to move on before my brain implodes. It was the there can be only one, and I'm like, no, implicitly. Implicitly not.
There can be only one happy Gemini on the podcast at any one time.
Oh, okay. Yes. The other one has to be.
Right.
It's like, yeah. You could have said it, but for, oh, God damn it. All right, I'm going to move on. First off, we have some business. What's the business? Patreon podcasts. We got one behind. If I talk about it in that way, it sounds less sincere. We got one behind, but we're not anymore. We're caught back up. Unless we don't get one out for this month ends, but we're caught back up now. Because we recorded a Patreon podcast just before this one. So if you notice this podcast seems unseasonably short, well, it's late. But that episode was actually the process of us selecting, actually, our next retroactive game. What is our next retroactive game? You're going to have to sit through this plug to find out. So where can you find our Patreon podcasts, John?
RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Fired.
Not quite.
God damn it. This is why we can't do ad reads for people, John. We're going to be trying to sell Bombas, and you're going to be like, I don't know.
The thing is, I would have answered RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com for literally any question
anything.
You asked.
Exactly. I was going to say, the thought of the terrifying subset of questions for which he still would have responded that.
We're going to be trying to sell Hex Tech socks, and you're going to be giving out the email address, and we're not going to get paid. Guillaume, where can we find Patreon?
Well, it's I guess the address is patreon.com/NWR.
Hey, we did it.
Huzzah.
Yes, that's where you can find
it. He was guessing too, so don't give me hell about it.
He at least answered the correct question.
Hey, why? It saved you the trouble of having to throw the email out there.
I'm still going to have to do it. You didn't save me anything. Patreon.com/NWR is where you can find our Patreon podcast and also other Patreon podcasts such as the NWR Rerun, which is a podcast where they review the news of a given week. This last one they did was 2012, and it was the end of the Nintendo Power. So that's the new story they were doing it about. So you can go check that out. It's a pretty cool show. That's $1 a month. You get all that stuff. You get all of it for $1. And you also get the satisfaction of knowing that you helped make this possible. You'll have to carry that weight. But what did we agree on? Well, like I said, this episode that might be out by the time this goes live was all about trying to figure out what we were going to play on this show for our 50th retroactive, the 2009 themed one. And so we decided to go with John.
Little King Story.
Hey, we didn't get the email address.
I feel like that was actually the incorrect response. I feel like he was being teed up to say that again, and then he went and actually answered the question properly. It was in its own way incorrect.
I was expecting the email address. I was dreading the email address, which is kind of a, it's like jumping out of the plane with the parachute, but you're not entirely sure if you have a parachute. In fact, you're pretty confident you don't, but I wasn't sure if I was going to hit the ceiling if I got the email address back or not, or if I was just going to sink into this chair and melt. But Little King Story for Wii, we will be playing that in the next few weeks. I don't have an exact date yet, because next week's show, next week some of us will be doing some stuff, and then but you have some time. Go buy yourself a copy of this game. It's really weird. Just as a FYI, the PC port is based on the PSP version, which has some significant differences between the Wii version. I can't list them to you right now because we haven't had time to look them up. We literally just decided this game. So that is our Patreon 50. So thanks to everybody who sent us their recommendations on what games we should be playing for this Patreon. We spent a long time going through.
I mean, it'll break John's balls for giving you the email address. Now you're conflating Patreon with retroactive.
Fucking hell! Retroactive. Yes. Retroactive. 50. Sorry. So yes, please participate. It's a lot of fun to get lots of comments in the talk back threads. So that will be our next retroactive episode, which we don't have a date for yet. So it will not be our next episode, though. So just to balance those two things out. But people who sent us recommendations could have done through the various web message board forums that are relevant to us. They could have done it through the Twitters. But the majority did it through email. And I'm going to ask our expert on what the email address is. Greg, what's the email address?
RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Why are you asking Greg?
Thank you, Robot Greg.
Yeah, you could have asked me almost anything, and I would have still said that. Because, again, that's
thank
just,
you, Greg.
I'm very easily swayed.
You know, at least I'm not John, the only one.
John is the trendsetter, the influencer, and, you know,
I am a noted influencer.
Favorite color, childhood memory, any of those things. I just want to give you the email address.
You just read what's on the teleprompter, Greg.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just, the idea of a bottom third with John on screen that reads John Lindemann colon influencer is just so haunting.
I love it.
So
I love it. But I like how broad that is. I'm just an influencer. I'm not an influencer on any one thing.
It is truly a ghoulish thought. Mm-hmm. It is. No horror movie has ever approached.
It suits our currently dark reality, so.
I like the idea of that being a plot, like the sort of behind the music of Star Wars. It's like Darth Sidious influencer. It's true. I mean, you can't really argue with that.
Yeah,
it's accurate. Because we did the Patreon episode, and it's late, we're going to try to keep the show relatively short. We're going to focus on email. We didn't have a ton of new business that couldn't wait. So we're going to roll right into emails. And in fact, I've had everybody pick out one email, and we all pick different emails, which is convenient. So emails go to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and you can send us yours just like these four individuals did. I will read the email I picked out, which comes from Top Hat Ant, who writes, Top Hat Ant, which is like, if you can't say it, but so fast, you'll stumble your syllables, who writes, gentlemen, we find ourselves in the golden age for visual novels. From first party to third party, from independent developers, everyone is trying to grab a slice of the VN pie. No need to worry about Joy-Con drift if the game doesn't have controls. No need to worry about battery life if the game doesn't have graphics. No need to worry about performance issues if the game can run on a toaster.
What does the V stand for if it doesn't have graphics?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A mystery.
It's a virtual novel.
It's the like
what
Sound
it, like,
Voyager, the GBA Bit Generations game, which the, I mean, I think it did have some graphics, but
it had,
really,
it had something on screen to tell
yeah,
you it was
it
on.
Was
basically.
Meant to be that you played it just using your ears through the headphone jack, really.
On a system that didn't necessarily have one.
good point. I guess they were kind of coming out alongside the Micro in Japan, which did have one, but it's still fair.
No to worry about... Okay, we did that one. The Switch and visual novels are a match made in heaven. So here's my question. Which upcoming or released visual novels on Switch have caught your eye? Do you have any deep cut recommendations? Nothing is too anime. Yours faithfully, Top Hat Ant. I mean, that's good because the baseline for visual novels on Switch for anime is extremely high. So visual novels is kind of a eye in the beholder thing. Like what?
Yeah, to the line between adventure games and visual novels.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I guess if with visual novels, I would have thought it would just be where there's very, very limited interactivity at all. You know, you're talking
right.
about you're just kind of going through the text, whereas you know, if you've got some kind of, like for instance, we've been playing Great Ace Attorney, and I would have thought that would qualify more as an adventure game because it does have investigation phases and things, you know, that where you do interact to some degree.
I've heard those games more frequently lately referred to as visual novels. And I think some of that comes from them paring down the openness of the investigation section. Like they're much more focused and linear than they were. If you go back to the very early Ace Attorney games where it's like, you can explore the whole world. There's a clue somewhere. Go find it. Great Ace Attorney does give you a little bit more freedom, but a lot of times, your assistant will literally tell you on the screen, I don't think there's a reason to go back there. It's like, oh, I wonder if she's got some thoughts on the issue. Or she'll say, like, it's been a long time since we've been. I bet we should go back. It's like, got it. Thanks for the hint.
When I stamp on your foot and say, hello, Mr. Thompson.
God, it's, yeah, so there is a certain amount of that. And if you count Great Ace Attorney, which I think I will, just because the sheer amount of just linear reading there is a lot of, you're not doing anything, you're just reading line after line. Yeah, it's great. And in fact, I just finished it today. Technically speaking, I basically stopped the game right before the credits started rolling to record the show. So after we're done, I will literally finish the game. But I did that. I did all the little like sub adventures that are in the bonus thing. Those get real weird. But again, that's on that fringe of like, is it a visual novel? Is it not? Like, I know the Zero Escape games are generally not considered visual novels because there's so much puzzle solving in them. But again, they're near that cut line. So it's always going to be different for who you're talking to. In terms of like a pure, absolutely pure, indisputable visual novel. I played Robotics Notes back in December. Played Red. Like there's very, very, very infrequently do you do anything interactive in it. There is a little bit. And I enjoyed it well enough. It was very anime. It was extraordinarily anime. But it's not, It's what's the best way of putting it? It's more upbeat and not particularly dark. Like there's some dark content in it. There's some stuff that would be considered upsetting. People get killed in fairly extreme ways. But it's not like emotionally dark or trying to be gritty or anything. Like it still has kind of like a youthful, like a anime targeted towards middle schoolers rather than like really more targeted towards direct adults. You know, it's really about like it's your high school life, but also the robotic apocalypse. So there's a certain amount of that in there. But I liked it. Of course, is this a visual novel or not? The Danganronpa games are coming to Switch relatively soon. And so that's another series that's really, really well liked. Nosia I haven't played yet, but I know there's people who really, really like it. It is much more of a pure visual novel. The two Famicom Detective Club games, again, are they visual novels or not? It's that kind of weird line. I liked both of them. They're very good. A lot of the classic PC visual novels that you might have heard of, you know, are pretty much all there. So, I had a list and it has disappeared on me. I literally had written them down. And I
have an article here if you want to go through a couple. This is from, this is from 2021, July 2021. So we got, they got Code Realize Guardian of Rebirth.
Yep, that's one of the more famous PC originals.
Yep.
Steins Gate's going to be on there, I bet.
Coffee Talk.
Yeah, that just came out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Caller X Malice.
Yep, that's another original PC one.
Doki Doki Literature Club Plus.
I can't believe it. I literally just played that. I can't believe I forgot. I enjoyed that a lot. Don't look up anything. Is Valhalla on there? VA11.
Let me just go through them. AI the Somnium Files.
Yep, that's one I need to play.
The House in Fata Morgana.
That game got out, or visual novel got amazing reviews when it came out.
Wow, it had a 100 score for a time.
It reviewed very, very well in general, but specifically Donald reviewed it for Nintendo World Report, and you don't read reviews like that very often.
No.
Just how much it seemed to make an impact. So that somebody doesn't play these sorts of games terribly often. That did pique my interest. Just the level of praise.
Yeah, yeah, really, really good. Steins Gate Elite.
Yep.
Deathmark.
Yep.
Arcade Spirits.
I haven't played that one. Read that one.
Yeah, it looks like an indie one. Valhalla, sir.
Yeah, that's really good. Really strongly recommended. I played it on PC and Switch. I find the controls much better on Switch.
Cool. Night in the Woods.
Yep. That's got a neat vibe to it. It's not anime at all.
Yep. I'm really realizing here that we're really stretching the visual novel.
Yeah, that one is much more of an adventure game, but at the same time, it is extremely linear. And I think that's kind of the distinction there, is that like it's not really got branching paths or anything. It's basically just you go down the route. You can see some alternate stuff depending on what route you take. But
at what point is Princess Tomato a visual novel?
Oh god damn it! Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah, but you're right. There's a category of things that are clearly visual novels, a category of things that clearly aren't, and then there's a handful of haze in the middle.
And if it isn't one, then why don't they make one where we could really get into the lore of the Salad Kingdom or whatever?
God damn it. Because we'd have to see more scenes of a cherry tomato coming out of the shower going like, you can watch if you like.
So good. All right, Dream Daddy is another one. It's more of a dating sim, but it's considered a visual novel, but that's probably very much...
Yeah, the dating sim visual novel thing is also in that gray space.
Yep. Monster Prom XXL.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I believe that's similar. It's in that dating sim area.
Yep. The Charming Empire.
Yeah, don't know.
It's another dating-based visual novel set in the Taisho Roman era of Japan shortly after the turn of the 20th century.
Okay, sure.
So sure it was going to be the Klingon Empire.
So close. So close. Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney Trilogy.
Yep.
And Clannad.
That is one of the all-time PC... I've actually never experienced it, but it's one of the all-time most famous ones. It's been adapted to everything.
to this list, I would add, even though it's not absolutely not a visual novel, Planescape Torment. Like, crank the difficulty of the combat down to nothing, and, like, there's so much reading in that game. There's a lot of puzzles, but, yeah, anyway, like, there's so, like, I feel like it's adjacent to visual novels.
Well, they sort of do that with the Radiant Historia remake, where there was, like, a mode that was essentially like that, in terms of it just turned off the combat, or it just made it really simple or something. I forget, it was... still yet to get around to playing that, but yeah, I do remember reading that in the reviews at the time.
I this is a pure, you are doing nothing but reading. I read, not played, World End Economica back on PC, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I recall enjoying it, I think. I don't know, it was like 7 years ago. But it's basically like what it, so it's set deep in the future where on a moon colony where they've hacked the economy with where some kid has hacked the economy with like basically trading bullshit stocks and stuff. And it's way too close to reality now. And I don't think I could have played it without screaming, "This is fucking crypto!" today. But 7 years ago, that wasn't a concern. They released that on Switch. It is massive. It, like, it's three books. It is so goddamn big. But yeah, it is purely reading. I don't know that I would want it at this point. But goddamn, that's a lot of content. it's weird though, to the broader question of like versus, hey, what should I be looking at? Just how many of these there are on Switch. And it's a lot of the same players. So like Sekai Games has done a number of them. And you know, like you can go look at these publishers who are doing them and then just search their name. I think Sekai Games, let's see, they've got a lot. And a lot of them are original PC games that they brought over. And, you know, there are things like, VNDB, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a visual novel database website. You can go look up some of the background on these things. And yeah, some of them on Switch look, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. I think it's the word embarrassing. Like, my girlfriend is a mermaid? !
That's awesome.
And yet
completely realistic. I'm just like, yeah, why wouldn't that be a game? Absolutely sounds like one.
Yeah, that summer I met you, the mermaid. But... you know, there's a lot of them that aren't that. There's a lot of them that are more normal games, more normal stories, or more just pure anime bullshit of a different variety. I would guess My Girlfriend is a Mermaid is also pure anime bullshit of some variety, but more normative pure anime bullshit. That's kind of why I liked Robotics Notes Elite. It was, you know, it was really kind of hitting that like high school anime robots thing, and there's a character who's basically just a fan of that shit in the game, and she's so positive all the time that she goes all the way from insufferable to likable. Like she's insufferable how upbeat she is regardless of the situation, but it makes it really hard to dislike her as a consequence, even though you're like, you are the worst, why are you like this? Which is hard to pull off, and so I appreciate that they did it. I'm sure if I sat here and scratched my brain for a while, I'd come up with a couple others because it is such a deep library at this point. But I think it's just that this is a really good format, for really good form factor for these kinds of games. The screen's big enough that it's easy to read. It's more portable than playing them on a PC. And I think the Japanese market, at least, given the popularity of Switch there, is well primed to receive these. And then there has been, for a number of years on Steam, a growing market of publishers who bring these things over officially with official translations and doing whatever localization is required to make these things work, usually pretty light. Almost never anything complicated like voice acting or anything. But it is still somewhat surprising to see the depth of them on Switch. I don't know if anybody has anything else they want to add.
No, but I'll probably pick up that Fata Morgana game.
I mean, that those reviews are ridiculous.
It has a 98 on Metacritic right now.
It's ridiculous.
For the Switch version. Like, that, I mean, I'm going to check that out. So.
Yeah, that's nuts. John, would you read our next email?
I absolutely can. All right. Matthew writes, hey, first time emailer, long time listener. Once the pandemic started, I decided to get into watching hockey. Watching hockey led me to wanting to play a hockey game. That's your first mistake. So I found a few of the newest games on Facebook Marketplace for $20 and figured I'd try them out. After about an hour or so of beating my head against the controls, I realized these games are just not for me, and unless you know how these games play, I don't think they are made for newcomers. The last game I played was Wayne Gretzky 3D Hockey on the N64. All that said, here's my question. Why the hell are sports games so impenetrable?
So yeah. I had this experience with the show. So mm-hmm. the show came out on Xbox this year, not just on Xbox, on Game Pass. And I very excitedly downloaded the show. Last year I was playing a shitload of Super Mega Baseball 3, which is an arcade game. And I found the show to be really hard to get into. And I like baseball a lot. And people love the show. There are people who adore it. But it demands a lot of you. Just for hitting, like, you need to know how to read pitches if you want to hit in anything higher than, like, the most basic level of difficulty.
Mm-hmm. And if he's talking about one of the newest NHL games.
He's got to be.
Yeah, he's got to be. And with that, what's really hard to grasp is that you control where you're skating and where your stick is independently, which
that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot to get used to.
That's hard to do in real life.
Yeah.
Trust me.
And
you can,
yeah. And there's a whole lot of ways. There's a whole lot of things going on. I mean, it's a lot to grasp. And, you know, especially like I'm coming from, you know, like my favorite sports games are NHL 94, Super Tecmo Bowl, things like that, where they're very similar. Now, the one thing I would say is if he wants to play a hockey game, he should play the NHL 94 remake that they put out very recently. I think it's NHL 94 Rewind, and that is NHL 94 just updated with new rosters. Unfortunately, there's no online play in it, so you can't play anybody online, but yeah, it's really good. It's really good. You'll get kind of sick of it probably, but it's really good, especially if you have somebody to play it with, like for like local co-op. It's really super fun. Sports games. The thing is with sports games is that, and you've seen this kind of with the Madden games, with you know MLB The Show, with all the NHL games. At a certain point, like most long-running game series, the only way that they have or the method that they have to up the ante is to just add more features, add more stuff. So you stretch these games out over a 20-year period, and you get these behemoth games that really compete with – they kind of ask or demand to be your bread-and-butter games. I think everybody has a kind of a bread-and-butter game, right? A game.
I mean, they've become gas games ultimately.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, maybe for some people it's, you know, Monster Hunter or something like that that you sink hundreds of hours into. These sports games have effectively become that. And so whereas, you know, back in the day, like say maybe like in the Super Nintendo days, like a sports game, you know, something like, you know, Super Baseball Simulator 1000, that might be a game that I play alongside a bunch of other games. But now these games, they're so, I wouldn't say they're bloated. There's a lot of good stuff in there. They're just such huge applications, for lack of a better word. There's so much stuff that they've crammed into these games that they kind of demand being your number one game, or like that's the game that you play. And so that's why I think I kind of moved away from them over time, because as they got bigger, it just playing them was so much more of a demand on your time and what you had to learn and the techniques that you had to learn to actually be good, especially playing people online. I mean, my God, people will just kill you online. You know, it's like not knowing how to play a fighting game and playing somebody online. You'll just get, you know, they'll just wipe the floor with you. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with them. Sports games have become their own, I mean, obviously they're their own genre, but almost their own subculture kind of thing.
That's
where
ecosystem.
Yeah.
You know, I get, there's also, I mean, I haven't played much of, like, you know, the mainline kind of sports games for a very long time now. I mean, it's probably like the mid-2000s is the last time I played Madden quite a lot. You know, and then probably the pointer-based Pro Evo from the late 2000s that's come up a few times in the past few months, a bit for soccer games. And yeah, other than that, just kind of arcadey stuff. I mean, a lot of it you got to think is just the annual nature of it. The fact that it just iterates on it every single damn year. It just, you know, it just gives it the opportunity to just, like, you know, keep layering complexity on top of it at a sort of at a pace that other games just wouldn't do normally. And you know, the fact that, you know, because the sports that they're you know, the leagues that they're, you know, trying to capture the appeal of are constantly changing and evolving with your players moving around and, you know, coaches moving around the state of the people, the actual fans of those games are kind of just accepting of that, you know what I mean? Like, oh, I've got to get the new game to kind of keep up with the changes in what's happened in the real league, and then I'll also keep up with the changes that's happened in this game, which presumably are a lot more gradual than they used to be. You know, when I was playing these sorts of games more regularly, you know, they were probably, especially, you know, with the console generations being shorter back then. You know, and you're transferring from 2D sprites to 3D, you have to, like, relatively primitive polygonal games to their more sophisticated polygonal games on GameCube and PS2 and all that. Like, they would change quite fast then. Nowadays, it seems like it's a lot more gradual, but, you do wonder, you know, how many things they have to try and therefore, like, convince you that they're adding things.
Especially with the NFL, Greg, where EA, they're the only game in town, so they have to make a game that appeals to literally everybody. There's and no more like, Quarterback Club versus Super Tecmo Bowl.
No, I mean, I had Quarterback Club and Madden, like, on N64, you know, back then. That was, you know, but by the time we got to GameCube, I guess, like, 2K was the last competitor. Yeah. And then they went away and you had the exclusive rights in the 2000s, and it's been that way ever since there. But I guess maybe you into today's market where the graphics and physics and everything are pretty much the same for a while and just very incrementally better, maybe puts more emphasis on trying to say there's new features and new complexity. Because otherwise you could be accused of just being a roster update, and maybe that contributes to this. It's just, you know, in terms of how I ever fell off playing Madden a lot, it is just like, yeah, if you fall off for a bit, it's kind of intimidating to go back.
Yeah.
If you don't keep up and with those incremental changes, then the changes aren't incremental anymore. It's a step change type of thing. And you feel like, maybe I wouldn't get into it. And then it just kind of gets progressively more daunting the more time goes on. So I think that's got to be a big part of it. Of course, the other part is now seemingly that a fair bit of the efforts with these games is more on just, like, different ways to extract money out of people with the fucking Ultimate Team stuff that we've mentioned before. Like, you know, it's just like, there's the idea of, you know, how can we sell this game to more people? But then there's how can we get more money out of the people who are going to buy it? And that kind of it seems like now that is a viable way of ginning up more revenue out of these games, that, you know, you don't have to worry so much about, oh, this isn't that accessible. You know, you can afford to look inward and just monetize your most voracious consumers of your product.
Yeah, I feel like sports games now are kind of whenever I play them, I feel like it's almost like a spectacle. It's almost something like where I look at it and I say, wow, that's really impressive. There's a lot here. And I'm like, okay, cool, I'm done with this. I just walk away from it because I'm just like, I don't actually want to play it. It's like I just kind of want to look at it. And I say, wow, that's really impressive. There's a Ultimate Team mode and, like, an NHL. Like, in NHL now, they have every team, like, on the planet in the NHL games now. They have, you want to play OHL, AHL teams, you want to play teams from like Russia or like the European leagues. It's all in there. And I kind of look at it and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. And I don't want to play any of it. I'm out of here. I just want to go play NHL 94. Thanks. See you later.
Yeah. I mean, I think picking up off Greg's point, you know, I look at the show and it looks like a baseball game, like visually, like it looks like I'm watching baseball on TV. And I think it would just be really hard for a game that looks like that to play in sort of the simplified arcadey style of like an RBI baseball.
Yeah.
Like I think just conceptually they don't mesh, because like that to look that good, you have to go model all the stuff in physics. Well, if you're modeling all the stuff in physics, how do you model it if the game plays super simplified? And I think that race towards realism feeds back into the game. Like I remember playing NCAA football back in like 2004, and they were trying for being really complicated and having super smart AI that would start to read things if you overplayed your hand. And you know, throwing a ball against the wind is not particular in like a monsoon, not a good idea. Or you know, running affects the slipperiness of the ball and stuff like that. But I mean, I've talked about it. PA fade worked every time because the AI was dumb. In a modern football game, that ain't going to fly. And that makes sense. If I played a game that looks like Madden does right now, and I could run the same play every time and get a touchdown, I would think they totally fucked up making this game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a bad game. What have you done? Yeah, even if that didn't work against players.
Yeah, because the goal of it is specifically trying to give you the most realistic representation of football.
Right.
Whereas so, before, it was just like, okay, here's a pseudo-representation of football that we're trying to make as realistic as possible,
well, I
but
guess
we really
it's,
can't.
It's just kind of, yeah, well, that's the thing is, in some ways, you know, you could look at these things and think, oh, it's so impressive, like, in some ways, that the back, like, I remember playing Madden 92, it would have been. I think just because like even the earlier versions of Madden like didn't even necessarily have like all the teams or mm-hmm. that many plays or, you know, so I mean,
yeah.
This is one of the earliest Madden sequels. And it is just like the fact that it does have the correct number of teams and players and the playbook that's got a bit of depth to it. And they didn't have the Players Association license in those days, but the player ratings, you know, corresponded to the numbers, you know, it's just I'm pretty sure that's Reggie White because he's just demolished the entire offensive line of the other team, you know, so that made it seem realistic. Like, it's like, oh, this is so realistic. Meanwhile, there was a ton of unrealistic shit going on. Like,
yeah,
you know, but,
right.
Because it was the most realistic that any approximation of, you know, the NFL had been up to that point. Then you kind of give it credit for the realism and then forgive it that it does have and forgive it all the sort of artifice that is inevitably there because it's a, you know, a 16-bit game, you know, trying to approximate a very complex sport.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that kind of balancing act worked, but of course we're past that now. You can't occupy that same kind of cake and eat it space of like aspiring for realism but also kind of profiting off the fact that you can't get there.
Well,
and it
right.
has a sort of simplicity and accessibility. But now it's like, well, no, if you want to be realistic, you could be damn realistic. You
and,
just
and
have to
every
spend.
Every game is slightly more realistic than its predecessor.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
well,
you just have
thing.
To spend a huge amount of time and money to make it happen.
Well, that's because of the console power, right? What's the first yeah. thing you do? If you're sitting there on the Madden team and a new console comes out and, hey, you know, the GPU is a lot better. The CPU is a lot better. What's the first thing you're going to do? Wow, I can use that extra power to make the AI so much better. Even though right. you don't, I mean, no developer is ever going to say, that power over there, that extra power, I'm just not going to use it. I'm going to keep the AI exactly the same. This is never going to happen. Even though, whereas like it used to be throttled back in like the Super Nintendo days, it used to be throttled by literally the power of the, you know, the CPU.
But they were just running routines. Like they yeah. weren't even, it wasn't AI. It was just like a pre-programmed response to what you did, yeah. or it would just yeah. randomly pick a play.
Exactly.
I mean, remember when we went into, I think it was the PS3, Xbox 360 generation, where they were made a big deal about the fact that they could put sweat on the players in basketball
yep.
games.
Yep.
And they just looked like they had been like a glazed Krispy Kreme donut. It mm-hmm. was ridiculous, yeah. but they did it.
No, because again, you keep the, it is a, especially over such a long period of time, it becomes a constant kind of line of attack or narrative. There's like, oh, it's just roster updates, you know, and right. they feel they have to push back against those sorts of things, especially at the start of a console generation. You're going to try and sell it a bit harder, you know, because, it's like, again, you want to avoid people falling off, as we've described, because I'm sure the makers of these sorts of games have seen themselves in data that when people fall off the wagon of constantly updating, they may not come back. Right. It does get kind of intimidating and stuff. So yeah, they try and push it all the time. Like, oh yeah, that one, you got to get this one. And sometimes, yeah, you're going to reach. And especially in retrospect, yeah, so, some of the things, yeah, and there were certain things that kind of, yeah, as much as it is like mostly additive, there were, I can think of some things that kind of came in and then went away. Like
the hit stick.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like that was a thing briefly, but that went away. So yeah, I mean, there's certain things that's just going to be trial and error, and you know, they're going to get feedback. And of course, I haven't played that many. And that's the big caveat here, is that, you know, I don't want to be unfair to these games, because, you know, I haven't played them recently. It hasn't helped them. You know, I might have been more likely to give something a chance if they'd had a better Nintendo presence over the mm-hmm. past many years. But, you know, I can only assume it's changed a lot as well, with everything, be as James mentioned, you know, games as service, and you know how online everything is and how much things are updating. And of course, that whole thing also just kind of, it doesn't sit that well with the annual model, and I just can't, surely it's not sustainable like indefinitely. Like if they're going to be really intensely online games anyway, what do you need to have an annual retail product for?
Because you can reset all the microtransaction cards for my team that everybody's collected back.
Yeah,
to zero.
I guess I wonder, you know, some combination of, you know, the user base or so. You just feel it doesn't make sense for that to continue in perpetuity. This is a, you know, a kind of anachronism. This is a vestigial thing of annual boxed releases, just like this husk just, you know, crawling into the future where it doesn't belong. It's
the treadmill of progression, but every year you throw the treadmill out and buy a new treadmill. But the 2K NBA games were notorious for like, oh, you want to customize your character in the slightest? Well, you got to spend money. And next year, that stuff didn't carry over. So, do you want to customize your character in the story mode for this new season? Haha, spend money again. You're right. I do wonder if there's a long-term viability there. If that marketplace will eventually collapse on itself. Doesn't seem to be any evidence of it at present.
Yeah.
My team continues to make obscene money.
The aforementioned lack of competition because of the licensing involved kind of makes it less responsive to, you know, any kind of market pressures.
But aren't you competing against yourself from last year too? Like, I'm competing against the game you already own. Because I can update the rosters.
And bad PR can be quite swift and punishing in today's media environment with how quickly it spreads. So there are other mechanisms rather than just, you know, purchases.
The other thing I would point out, which might help a little bit here, this came up when Metalhead, who makes Super Mega Baseball, was allowed themselves to be purchased by EA. And I speculated at the time that EA is buying to make a baseball game because that's what they do. It's the only thing they've ever done is make baseball games, make arcadey baseball games. And they're best of breed at it. But Super Mega Baseball 3 and Super Mega Baseball 2 are not hugely different. It's a refinement. EA bought them to make a baseball game. Like, if EA wanted to make anything else, they would have built their own team. Presumably to make an arcadey baseball game. And there's no reason for Super Mega Baseball to have sold if they plan to just keep making unlicensed baseball games, because they could do that themselves and keep all the money. And there's no reason for EA to have bought them if they wanted to do that either, because I doubt that has the return EA wants. I would guess you're looking at a potential MLB licensed game from them, which has simplistic but modern gameplay style, and I think that's potentially a market, and I think they could make money. I mean, MLB has their own RBI baseball, which is that but bad. Maybe that will set a precedent that, oh, you can actually make these retro style games and make money on it. I mean, you talked about NHL 94 Rewind. That was basically a tie in to the annual 2K game, right?
It was EA.
Oh, the EA game, excuse me. NHL, it was basically a tie into NHL 21, right?
Yes, yeah, it was. Yeah.
Okay, but yeah. They do sell it separately. But yeah. I mean, it was basically
it was like a pre-order bonus kind of thing.
Yeah. And so there could be a real potential for people to realize, or people in power to go down that road and start producing games closer to what the audience is looking for. I just worry that with the Ultimate Team cash.
Yeah.
It seems like normally you'd say, well, surely if you make these things impenetrable, as is posed in the question, and, it's just a case of, newcomers are kind of put off. Over time, that's not that sustainable, right? Like, you're just going to lose players, and therefore, there's only one way that your kind of profits off these things are going to go. But it doesn't necessarily seem that that's the case when you can monetize your kind of diehards as effectively as seemingly you can do now. And also, I think the biggest thing as well is that with these games, probably because of their close ties to the leagues that they kind of represent, you get people early, you get kids, and they are willing to kind of go through everything's over kids' heads when they're little. So that's not necessarily going to be that off-putting, especially if they love, their particular team or that league in general. Like, they're willing, and especially if you've got like older siblings to kind of shepherd them through it. And therefore you do still have your new intake of fans to keep it going. It isn't just that you lose people over time.
Yeah. I mean, I think with NHL Rewind, I mean, if they were willing to sell like a roster update and team update once a year, I would buy that. If they sold it for like $10 or something like that, I would probably buy that into perpetuity. I would just update it every year.
I've always wondered
why they don't do that.
It's for the very special kind of consumer that wants to play NHL 94, yep, but with the Seattle Kraken.
Yes, exactly. God. Yes.
Well, with the very good and definitely not broken expansion draft.
Mm-hmm. It worked really well before. I don't know what your problem is. I mean, the Knights.
Did it work really well?
The Knights went to the finals and then didn't have to expose any of their players to this expansion draft. That proves that it worked well. I think you'll find.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on before I get sad. Guillaume, would you read your email?
My email? Sure. John writes, "Dear RFN crew, I was in law school when the GameCube came out, and did not have the money to buy it or the time to play it. It is the only major Nintendo console that I've not owned. I've been thinking about using my Wii to play GameCube games that I missed, but I'm not sure if it's worth the relatively small investment in a memory card and a controller. I have played the re-releases of Wind Waker and Super Mario Sunshine. I would love to play Path of Radiance, but the price is prohibitive. The only game that really sticks out to me is Rogue Leader, and I'm not sure it justifies the investment. What games can be purchased at a reasonable price are worth playing in 2021?
On the GameCube?
On the GameCube. So I picked this email thinking like, oh, like based on the title, basically like, oh, GameCube suggestions, sure. But yeah, I had kind of forgotten that the prices are nuts.
Yeah, well, very recently, in the past year and a half or whatever, I imagine, yeah, it's probably gone very, very sideways. Although it's worth mentioning, Wind Waker and Super Mario Sunshine are a reference there, but a lot of the notable stuff on GameCube has kind of escaped it in one form or another.
Right. That's the thing. I'm seeing a lot of remasters or like versions that I would not recommend today. Rejoice, John, you can pick up True Crime Streets of LA for $6 on the GameCube.
Oh, yeah, Snoop Dogg. Sweet. There he is.
Sweet.
Was he in the first one or was he in the sequel?
I think he's in both.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think we talked about this. I can't believe it.
look, it was a different era, and Snoop didn't have all the money he has. He hadn't done his Martha Stewart TV show yet. That's a real thing. If you don't believe me, you can Google it. They have done a multi-season TV show together.
I mean, he's doing Corona ads. He's just did the Olympics with Kevin Hart. I mean, he's a cottage industry.
I was with you on he just did the Olympics with until you got to the last part, and then I could just imagine somebody screaming the whole time. So
well, yeah, I mean, they're basically doing kind of a, you know, Mystery Science Theater 3K sort of thing of the Olympics.
What if we did that, but I had a mute button for just one half of them? So yeah, I mean, Rogue Leader is, if you like Star Wars, Rogue Leader is definitely worth it. It's a cool, I mean, that game still looks nuts today.
Yeah, I've not played it in so long. I wonder how it would hold up or not.
It struggles being on an HDTV because it
well,
is 4K.
Well, I kind of remember it struggling being on any TV. Like I remember being disappointed. I got my GameCube a little bit late. I rented Rogue Leader and I was really annoyed that you were meant to try to pick off TIE fighters in the blackness of space. I thought they were really hard to see, and like there was like this onboard computer that you could press the white button. Yeah, but the you had to hold the button down, and like then like did the game look that great when you were using the computer? From what I remember,
use the
it was
Force,
kind of...
asshole! Come on, watch the movie
canonically. Of course. You know, I mean, how often are you even playing someone who can do that?
I'm pretty sure that's a quote from one of the films. Use the Force, asshole.
Exactly.
I think that was Obi-Wan Kenobi that said that.
Yeah.
In one of his, drunken rages.
He said, I have the high ground. Like, come on. Like, it's nowhere near as bad. He's standing on a rock that's like a foot taller.
Obi-Wan's had a bit too much to drink again.
But it's still probably a good Star Wars game to pick up if you're into Star Wars right now.
And it just didn't. I know there was all those rumors or whatever that they basically had like a trilogy game ready to go for Wii, and you know it got scuttled or something. Right. You know, so that's one of the games that did not manage to kind of escape GameCube. Because, I mean, Nintendo's own stuff, Luigi's Mansion, I talked about the 3DS version of that not long ago. But even, you know, the sequels, even if they hadn't ported it to 3DS, and I guess, you know, you could say like, sort of like Mario Kart Double Dash has never kind of escaped GameCube, but again, there are subsequent Mario Kart, right. So it's right. Kind of, unless you have a very particular interest in the way that kind of handled the like being able to play as a pair and stuff, I'm not sure that it makes a very compelling case. And then even some of the more interesting third party things, you know, like years ago I might have said Ikaruga, but that's like on all sorts of things now, including Switch. It's something we did a retroactive on a while ago. Beautiful Joe, like that's not really available elsewhere, is it?
And
it's still
No.
Yeah, not really. And it's still pretty affordable. I'm seeing like 22 US. So yeah, that's very affordable. And like, this is one of my all time favorite games. So definitely highly recommended if you're willing to invest some time in it and to learn how to play it, because it's not the most intuitive, kind of scoring system.
No, that's true. We did a retroactive, so it's all in there for an in-depth kind of evaluation. But I definitely, when I played it the first time, yeah, without the content, especially like when we did the retroactive, it was after having played, you know, Platinum's sort of somewhat similar games to, you know, this was obviously Clover under Capcom, but, you know, some of the same people. You know, I played it with a very different context and appreciated what was going on with the scoring and stuff much more so. But yeah, presumably, you know, you could go into that with that knowledge today, and it just, you know, it's a kind of side scrolling take on there. Kind of character action formula that they would go on to have in Platinum. So it's that's pretty much the top one that I could think of as something that's did it literally stay exclusive, or did it maybe it showed up on PS2, but that was it?
I think it might have showed up on PS2.
It was on PS2.
Pretty much everything all the Capcom 5 ended up on PS2 except for PN3.
Oh no.
Right.
To keep only the greatest game.
So basically what I did is I went through eBay and tried to pick off like the stuff that I liked it was not too prohibitively expensive. But I kind of wonder, like, John doesn't seem to be that eager to dive into the GameCube library if it's going to cost some money. So I don't know, like, you don't have to, the letter writer. Like, if you think that doesn't sound worth it, but
he's not honor bound to buy every game we name, or I'm gonna start naming ridiculous shit. So yeah,
Super Monkey Ball, pretty affordable at $10, but that's getting, you know, it's releasing soon on Switch, so you don't need it
as part of a collection.
It's been remade on a bunch of stuff or re-released, so.
But again, this is going to be really, really current, isn't it? You're going to get, and it's levels from 1, 2, and Super Monkey Ball Deluxe. Like, it's, mm-hmm.
I might pick that up, man. I'm just kind of in the mood for that.
Yeah, it seems like it looks pretty decent. There's
Cosmo Kiryu on Switch.
Mm-hmm. Right. Gladius. For $40, you get, maybe you can't afford Fire Emblem, but maybe you can afford the LucasArts made similar, you know, strategy turn-based RPG set in, like, Roman times.
Yeah, you're playing, like, a Roman, gladiator. It's a gladiator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But against, like, mythological creatures. That. Right. But against mythological creatures like fauns and centaurs and stuff like that. But I remember it being pretty good and very long, and I don't think I ever finished it, but it was good stuff.
It reviewed well.
Yeah, so Rogue Leader, kind of, that seems to be a PAL copy. I don't know if the US copies are...
Rogue Leader goes for about $14.
Okay, not too bad. Sphinx and the Cursed Mummy is maybe better than you would think. It's kind of a cross between the Zelda game and Wario Land 2 or something. But it has been remastered for Switch, so you don't need this.
which is unbelievable.
Odama is $20, probably less. You need a mic to play it, a GameCube mic, but that's worth also the investment. I'm sure that there's like a used game shop somewhere with a Ziploc bag full of them that it can sell you for $1. But if you don't want to invest the money in Odama, you could just type RFN 400 in YouTube, and you can see us play Odama, or I think it was mostly John and James were playing it while I was still sleeping.
With some difficulty.
If you want to have the authentic Odama experience, stare at a static picture on a wall and yell at it and be upset it doesn't do what you tell it to do.
Yep.
By the way, I'm looking at all these videos, they don't have that many views. I'm pretty disappointed. 209 views, the most watched. Can you guess which is the most watched?
It's going to be BMX Triple X, isn't it?
Absolutely, with 1,500 views.
Damn it.
In second position, surprisingly, let me scroll down, it's George of the Jungle for Wii.
Oh, for fuck's sake. John and I played that like the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Yep. So 700 people have watched it. So thank you for your service.
I think it was. Oh.
Maybe it's the only footage of that game on the internet. Who knows?
It might be. Like, I wouldn't be stunned. The ill-fated Cartoon Network reboot of George of the Jungle. So
a similar recommend that had related because at one point it was Adama was wasn't just going to be using the microphone, it was going to be using the bongos.
Oh shit, you're taking the one I was about to name.
Yeah, I think Jungle B did, which we've mentioned earlier on in terms of DK Punch Out, it did escape GameCube. It's a new play control game. Yeah. So again, in that sense, it's not the strongest candidate, but it was the new play control version. I've played it. It's fine, and it's nice that it gave, you know, a better chance for more people to discover that game, which I just think is fundamentally a very good game. But it was designed to be used with the bongos. That's the way it was meant to be played, and it plays better that way, not surprisingly, as a result. So there is that. I guess it's not great because we're talking about extra hardware again. And I mean, when I didn't get Jungle Beat and the bongos when they were current, it was like a few years later, three or four. And at that point, they were dirt cheap.
Like, they still are. You can get the bundle for like 20 something bucks.
Well, that's good. Yeah, cause I obviously, cause I own them, I haven't been keeping tabs on how much it's worth. So, God knows what's going on out there these days.
Yeah, who knows?
That's good to hear because that is a very unique experience, you know, that you genuinely feel like, you know, that is not something you're going to get. Whereas, you know, I mean, there's plenty of good games on GameCube, but so many of them have like analogs, or, you know, arguably they've been superseded. I guess some people would say like Melee has never been surpassed or something. So you could get Smash Brothers Melee or something. I personally wouldn't fall into that camp despite the great deal of affection I have for that game. But Jungle Beat is just really something of its own. But equally, it fits into this lineage of, you know, Eerie Tokyo, and it's kind of like the bridge between Sunshine and Galaxy in a weird way. But you have to be open to the idea of, like, it's quite short, it's quite easy, it's really about score. It's about your performance through the levels and you know, getting better at it and mastering the combo system and stuff. So, you know, some people just bounce off those kinds of things, so you'd have to ask yourself, you know, is that something I could get into?
So I'm going to go through a few. Unfortunately, some of these are more expensive than I would like to name. I think the two Vaten Kaitos games, for their historicness, these are Nintendo's first foray with Monolith Soft. And in fact, Nintendo bought Monolith Soft between the two. And of course, that has been probably one of the best investments Nintendo ever made. Hmm. They have contributed to every Zelda console game since Skyward Sword, actually. So that's Baten Kaitos and Baten Kaitos Origins. Baten Kaitos is like $60. It's for a complete game. It's probably cheaper for just a disc. It's a little pricey. Baten Kaitos Origins, just shoot yourself in the foot. I think it's like, to get in the door, you're talking about $100 for just a disc.
It was very late, and I don't think they printed that many of them.
No, they did not. But I really like it. I think it's a really good game, so I had to mention it. Same deal with, Skies of Arcadia Legends. That game is laugh at yourself funny, because, like, are you a fool? If you're trying to buy this game, you probably are. It's very expensive. But if you happen to somehow get a chance to fleece somebody for a copy, you know, fleece away. Pray for absolution from your god at some other point. Soul Calibur 2 is actually a really, really good game. And this is the one that has Link in it, which is why it's the version of Soul Calibur 2 that sold the most.
Yes. Because
apparently Link outsells Spawn from Spawn. Shockingly, I know. But Soul Calibur 2 was
the Xbox version. I mean, it was never, you know, Soul Calibur was probably always going to be likeliest to sell best in a console that actually existed in Japan.
Sure, yeah. But even outside Japan, it was the GameCube one sold really well. It's Soul Calibur 2 is a stunningly deep amount of content, including single player content in this game. Just an absolute ocean of just stuff you can do. And it also, it's really goddamn good. Like, it's really good. It is shockingly good how good that game is.
But it's pretty deep. I remember I got that, and anyway, I got the game guide at the same time. And the moves were like, you know, like if you press forward, down, and, you know, like, a button, it would be one move, but then like if you fold that up with a different command, like it would do something else. Like,
yep.
The game guide was basically a list of combos, but for moves. Like, I don't know, like so it can be like it can be tough to master, so you need to know what you're getting into.
Yeah, but set some time aside for it.
Soul Calibur 2 is also relatively approachable to get into. Like, you can pick that game up knowing nothing and still get some cool-looking shit out.
Yeah, you can button mash and things will happen on screen.
It still looks good.
Yeah.
Again, another game that is unfortunately kind of expensive is Eternal Darkness. That is another game that has never escaped. It is... I don't know how I would feel about playing it in 2021.
Yeah, like, this was another
retroactive game. Obviously, it was quite a long time ago now, because I think it was one of the earlier ones. I'm not sure if it was in 09 or maybe 10, but, you know, it was one of the earlier ones. So at that point, the game was getting on for a decade old, but yeah, not obviously it's much older now. And so I'm not sure if it would have aged a bit more by comparison, but yeah, it's another one that you've got to say is kind of associate it quite a lot with that early phase of the GameCube. Mm-hmm. And I guess it give you kind of a flavor of what was, you know, kind of going on the platform. And it's another game, of course, like Star Fox Adventures, that kind of was an N64 game. A late N64 game before it was a GameCube game.
Yes.
1080 Avalanche, if you like racing games that are set in, I don't know, that like snowboard games that are more, like kind of racing games at the same time. Like, it's a sequel to the N64 game, and it's pretty decent. And it's, I don't know, this one ships from Canada for like less than $10, but, no bids on it, so I don't know how you actually, you know, how much you normally would pay for it. I see F-Zero GX for like $12. That feels unlikely. So
I mean,
it sells in like 5 days. I get the feeling that it ships from.
If I was thinking earlier on, like, you know, I was, you know, talking about stuff like Melee and Mario Kart and all that, and it's like, well, what's a series that wouldn't have been surpassed for some reason? Oh, right, the one that they don't make any games for anymore.
That's a reason.
But if you can find that cheap, go for it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Brilliant.
I'm seeing Soccer Slam. Remember that game?
Soccer Slam was fun. We talked about that before. Yeah. It was a multi-platform game, so I'm not sure if it might
need a GameCube for this, but still.
Yeah. I think it launched on GameCube and then made its way to other stuff. I think that was the deal.
And like, speaking of which, so if you don't want to jump through whatever hoops John was doing to play Time Splitters 2, I guess you could do that on GameCube as well.
Yes,
right?
You could.
True.
How much is Time Splitters 2 now?
Yeah, it can be a little bit expensive on the GameCube, the copies that I've seen, though. The Hulk game for the GameCube surprisingly amazing, at least at the time. I don't know how much it holds up, but basically it's a, you know, it's an open world, you've got a big open city. And as you played through the game, Hulk would get more powerful, like you would unlock new moves, but you would do stuff like, you know, like, oh, you're being chased by helicopters that are annoying you. Well, you can just throw like one helicopter again, you know, on the other, make them explode or pick up their missiles and throw them back at them. You could, fashion like metal gloves out of like a car. Or you could just throw the car at the tanks and things like that. So, yeah, it was like, I don't know, surprisingly fun. It was kind of like, GTA, if it was a brawler with, you know, a big green dude. And yeah, it's still pretty, affordable. It's like $20. I would actually recommend that. And if you want a co-op game, the Lord of the Rings games, the Two Towers and the Return of the King, apparently still, affordable, and, they were really fun.
They made a lot of copies.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, it's just kind of a button masher. Like you choose your character and then you go destroy some orcs and some catapults or whatever. You do some, you know, dial combos. I don't know. They were just fun to go through. So I would recommend that. Cool. Yeah. Outside of that, Wave Race, Blue Storm, I'm seeing a good quote unquote copy. Oh, game on only for $15. But it's pretty decent.
It blows my mind how many GameCube discs have ended up as game only. Like, why in God's name would you throw away the box to a GameCube disc?
Well, you save so much space.
Lose the disc.
It gets less of a problem if it was the Japanese cases because they were so nice and small.
Yeah, like my dose in the giant cases makes me happy because there's an irony there. which, by the way, sure, Doshin the Giant, but not the PAL one because it only does 50 hertz. So you play it in Japanese. Trust me, there's no linguistic loss. It's just weird groany noises and like rah sounds. You're fine. It'll be great. Any other games?
That's probably enough to start with.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, look, we've just probably listed off like $6,000 worth of games. So you might have been in law school when the GameCube came out. I hope you've had a long and successful career so you can begin.
You're going to be able to spend it now, buddy.
It is surprising just that more seem to get, like, you know, I mean, like, I don't know whether this would have been the most obvious candidate just because it was import only, but like Mr. Driller Drill Land, like that came back on Switch.
Yeah.
It was a late pickup, but that is a GameCube game I really like. But even that, like, and it was GameCube exclusive, like Mr. Driller stuff has been on, well, certainly was in its day, like on everything under the sun, all the different formats, you know, Game Boy, Color, PS1, you know, everything. But that game was GameCube exclusive, and even that's just come back randomly. So it is, and with the Monkey Balls coming back and all that, it's nice in a way because, you know, there were only 20 million GameCubes sold. So, you know, it's nice that the people have had a chance to kind of come back around to some of this stuff. But it would also be nice if Nintendo, you know, actually sold some more of these, you know, kind of individually at some point. Maybe with the sort of emulation tech that they seemingly it was underpinning Super Mario Sunshine in the 3D All-Stars collection, but, you know, we're yet to see it.
Yeah. There's so many games that we just can't play thanks to the GameCube being outrageously expensive that it makes me sad. So I wish more people could play Skies of Arcadia Legends because it's really fun when it's not being an asshole. But all right, let's move on to our final email. Greg, would you please?
Very good. One writes, for each one of you, what are your personal top 5 final boss theme songs from a game published by Nintendo? I personally love certain Mario-related ones because they don't deserve to be so epic for the kind of game they come from. So we have the grand finale for Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story, which I believe has been requested and used as end music some years ago on this show. Fated Battle from Super Mario Galaxy 2. Showdown at the Tower from Donkey Kong for Game Boy, aka Donkey Kong 94. Rainbow Ships from Mario Hoops 3-on-3, which is a Square Enix game. So I do want to develop. So I wonder if it's got some like stealth Square Enix RPG final boss juice. And The Ultimate Show from Super Paper Mario. Of course, there are many others from Nintendo, like O2, which is a Kirby final battle theme song, Battle Champion and Red from Pokemon, Gangplank Galleon from Donkey Kong Country, or the several Ganon/Ganondorf themes. But I just wanted to exemplify with the Mario series. I limited the question to 5 for brevity, but you can expand or shrink as you wish. Yeah, which, I mean, to be honest, I'm terrible at ordering things, so, yeah, I don't know, if I'm gonna be able to give a top 5, but certainly just, a number of ones that I really, really enjoy. I mean, and I've got to say, some of my favourites are not Nintendo developed, even though there's plenty of good Nintendo developed ones. But if you think of famous like final boss themes, like one of the first ones will probably be Dancing Mad from Final Fantasy VI, which, you know, as a strong connection to Nintendo, it's on the Super Nintendo Mini and all sorts of things. But yeah, I mean, that is pretty special. I think one of the things that, final boss themes kind of, you see them do quite a lot. Is, you know, understandably so. It's like, you've got to sell the fact that this is the culmination. You know, this is the climax of the game. Everything in the game has led up to this point. So you kind of have to, you kind of sell that in a number of ways. First of all, you've got the sheer kind of scale that you go for. It's big, it's bombastic, it's epic. Certainly Juan's suggestion for Fated Battle from Galaxy 2 fits into that category. It's, you know, with the choir and everything, it's so, so big. And then the boss fight's really easy and lasts before the song gets going. Like, it's so sad.
That happens in JRPGs a lot if you're over-leveled.
Yeah, if you're over-leveled, that's the thing, I guess, because they, you know, it's sort of predicated normally on the fact that, like, the boss fight is going to be really long and it's got multiple phases and stuff. But, like, one of the things that Dancing Man does in the sort of, when it moves into the last phase, where it goes full on, like, prog rock, is it plays the sort of organ dirge from the title screen, where it shows Final Fantasy, the logo on fire, where, you know, so it's like, it's got it tying it all the way back into the start of, like, you know, this is what the whole game was about. You know, that is when they pull it off, it's really, really good. You also have, like, the sort of dueling of leitmotifs thing is very big, so get character themes that have been established over the whole game. We bring them together and they sort of clash against each other, kind of thing. A good example of this would be the sort of first half of the Larvos fight in Chrono Trigger has a lot of that going on. The second, not so much. The second is weirder, but which kind of makes sense for what happens throughout the course of that kind of fight. That's, you know, terrific. But again, very heavily associated with Nintendo, but not actually Nintendo itself. So
yeah, the end boss for Bravely Default 2, I talked about at the time when I was talking about what music I picked for our ending theme. The end boss theme plays the primary characters' themes against each other and bastardizes the theme of the character who ultimately was masquerading as the end boss and does a bunch of other weird stuff to play on the theme that's going in it. Actually kind of tells the story of the game through what themes it ends up laying in, but they're all corrupted and weird because, as in the true Bravely Default form, the end boss is trying to unmake reality, as is the case in all those
games. Yeah, I mean, the final music for, I think it's called The Serpent That Eats the Horizon or something. It's from the first Bravely Default. I mean, that is a corker. That's got a lot
going on. It's like 12 minutes long.
Well, it's got, I think it's like three distinct phases. You know, so if you were to have the song on an album and it's like 7 minutes long or whatever, but it's like the first 2.5 minutes like would just loop as long as you're in the first phase of the boss.
Right.
And then you segue into the second phase of the boss, and then that would loop for the next 3 minutes or whatever until you get into the last phase. But yeah, the most memorable part of that for me is where you get the four sort of like themes for the characters that you were when you used like the super ability or something, wasn't it? Like
right.
there was an ability that you would use that would trigger that character's theme in battle, and it reprises all of them like back to back to back to back, but very up tempo, like quite heavy, like very different and very much more urgent and befitting like the last boss. And it is, it just like is meant to make you feel like, oh, you know, it's the final phase and you're about to beat it. You are going to win this, which at times was dishonest because I lost that boss fight quite a few times, even when I was really near the end of it. But it musically, it just works beautifully. It's very, very memorable.
The presentation of that game's boss fight is completely out of bounds of anything I've ever seen in a game, and it's on 3DS. Like even its sequels, do not attempt the sheer resplendence of what they're going for in that game's end fight. It's absurd. Greg, do you have any others you wanted to touch on?
Well, I'm trying to go with stuff that's more squarely in Nintendo territory. So,
yeah,
first of
I've
all,
got a few. So.
Zelda-wise, obviously, it was mentioned by Juan. I think Breath of the Wild's final boss is exquisite. That's really, really good. Again, it's one of those ones that feels like it's very much like let's go back to the beginning, because you kind of have the main theme of the whole game very prominent, but also you just have like the kind of motif for just like when you encounter a guardian in the field, like something that's very basic, something that you will do, you know, probably associate most like with doing so early in the game when you're very ill-equipped to go up against the guardian. But now you're going up against the last boss. But of course, it's embellished, you know, made like really even more bombastic and epic, and the piano is extremely busy and extremely hard in this. It's just really going as hard as it can possibly go. And then it's got dynamic elements in it, you know, so that it obviously it's not a movie. It's not a scripted, you know, kind of boss fight where everything happens at a particular point where you can score it, you know, for individual cues moment to moment. But it's got dynamic elements such that, you know, it does match to some extent what's happening in the boss battle itself, especially for like when you're going to deal the final blow to it and everything. It's really, really good.
I have a few that are squarely Nintendo published games. And the Fire Emblem is really good about making sure you know you're fighting the last boss. Like they want to make sure you know what you're up against. So Twilight of the Gods and Fire Emblem Echoes is everything. It starts out with just strings sort of slowly building off repetition. It throws it all the way into operatic singing and sort of stressed, high tension piano chords. Because that fight sucks. That's a long fight against, I mean, as the name would say, a dying god who's not particularly happy about it. Again, with using people who are decidedly not gods. And the fight goes, if you're playing that game on a hard difficulty, the fight goes pretty much how you'd expect. Throwing a bunch of mercenaries against a literal god. Not particularly well. But it's kind of constantly building to these plateaus And then it almost always falls into really aggressive action coming out of them. So it has this constant cycle of build, soft, and then rapid fall into an explosion of music, and then it kind of picks back up. Three Houses and Final Boss, Apex of the World, is a mix of a couple bit of the main theme of the game, but it's been cranked in a bunch of different directions to sort of increase the sort of like drama of it all. You know, the instrumentation's been changed. There's this weird chanting that runs under the theme, almost prayer-like, which again makes sense because depending on what side you're on, you're either fighting a god or you're fighting for a god. There is a couple different variations depending on what's going on, depending on the current state of the battle, depending on who you're fighting against, which they refer to as Thunder and Rain, I believe, are the two mixes in question. It's got a hard kind of drive under it. It's a very interesting kind of song to break down into little pieces and sort of just listen to the individual lines. But really how it individually, some of that stuff doesn't fly. It's actually more about how it's built like a layer cake kind of makes them work. But the winner here, I think, and this is tough, is probably Xenoblade 2, whose final boss theme is called After Despair and Hope. Because it does a couple different things that are interesting. One, there's absolutely no question you are fighting something of significant peril. And I don't want to go into too much detail about what you're fighting, but you are fighting for the state of existence at that point. And there's a sort that like the song has a deliberate intention of impacting a sense of awe of what you are up against. There's a number of musical cues that it knows when you're going to hit that layer out. I want to say that the song kicks it into a second gear when the fight actually starts, like it's time synced to the fight actually starting. But it keeps continuing to build. And look, Xenoblade 2 soundtrack is unbelievable. Like it just is. It's a remarkable soundtrack in its own right. And so it's not particularly surprising that the final boss theme is really, really good, because one thing those games do is drama in their music, and that one is certainly no exception.
Well, and I think it's a sort of tradition. Obviously, Mitsuda worked on Xenoblade 2, worked on Chrono Trigger, you know, one of his earliest ones that we already mentioned. I feel like there's a pretty, with JRPGs, they feel quite keenly that responsibility of, like, you know, this game, especially Chrono Trigger, was quite brief by the, you know, the latter day RPG standards, but you know, there's been these big quests, and now you have to sell the idea that this is it. This brings together everything that's come before it, and everything's at stake for the characters, the world, whatever. And they take that responsibility seriously, and they often do a really, really good job of doing it. Juan mentioned the Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story final boss theme, which is Shimomura, of course. But also the Luigi, the Dream Team brother. I was thinking, which one's the Luigi one again? This is a weird thing to say when it's called Mario and Luigi, but yeah, the Dream Team is where it's so much of it is in Luigi's head. And, I think it's like the penultimate boss, the Antasma boss battle theme, but that's great. And Yoko Shimomura, of course, who worked on the original Xenoblade, but not two, has done many, many great battle themes.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts about the Xenoblade 2 theme is it works in Counterattack, which is one of the battle themes from the game, but in a very different instrumentation. And then it works in one of the story themes, what plays during a lot of the credits, or during a lot of the not a lot, but during some of the video sequences, a theme called Loneliness, which is usually, as you can imagine, played when everything's gone wrong for the party, which in Xenoblade 2 happens a lot. They kind of have everything go wrong a bunch of times. And so, like, how it plays in there was thematically appropriate for the bosses that you're fighting. Because the final boss of Xenoblade 2 is complete anime nonsense, but there is sort of a... Those games are trying to do something with their theme and their thoughts. Whether or not they succeed is up to the audience, but they at least put that in the attempt. So it worked out really well. I don't know. Who else?
I mean, the final boss for Xenoblade Chronicles X has a similarly... Actually has two themes, but the first one is especially over the top, and it's like just complete, you know, guitars and... You know, no crazy lyrics. Crazy lyrics are saved for the second one. I think the first one is like Lao Chimera, and then the second one is The Key We've Lost, I think.
Yeah.
But they're both pretty good.
The Key We Lost is weird because it shows up in trailers. You don't usually put the final boss theme in your reveal trailer. It's in the reveal trailer!
Yeah.
The very first trailer of the game, when the game still had a protagonist character, it plays The Key We've Lost in it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, no, it's the second one. It's the one after we've dumped it. The first one just plays the new LA theme, I think. But not the new LA theme we all love and respect and never make fun of.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lao Chimera is really good. The Key We've Lost is a lot. It's too much.
It's a little bit over the top, yeah. I like Lao Chimera.
Suwano has like setting as like the setting dial from I can't remember the name of the movie now. It goes to 11, but he doesn't
Spinal
have
Tap.
It's Spinal Tap, but his doesn't have anything lower than a 9. So there's a problem. His dial goes 9 to 11, and it's kind of busted, so it gets stuck in the 11.
They call that the Giuliani model.
Yes! It's like, okay, I need you to be calm here. What? All right. Okay. Cool. Thanks, buddy. Just do what you gotta do.
I don't know. Like I don't think I think about the boss music enough to have really good answers, except for some reason Yoshi's Island's final boss comes to mind. But I don't know, just because it's like so weirdly introduced, you know, like you first like you've got this little cute battle against you know, a young Bowser trying to get on Yoshi's back and it's in this player room and stuff, but then Kamek supersizes him, and so like that destroys the castle that you were in, and out of the rubbles, like you hear like this kind of ominous flute, I suppose. It's hard to tell exactly what instruments they're going for because it was the Super Nintendo, but anyway, like this kind of ominous flute, and then you see Bowser rise in the back, and then like the electric guitar kicks in.
The Super Nintendo guitar is in full effect, which I don't think like that it hasn't that hasn't featured in the game to that point. I don't think. Really.
No, I don't think. No,
it was a common thing in Super Nintendo soundtracks, especially like Capcom ones, like Mega Man,
right? But not particularly Mario games, though.
No, exactly. Yoshi, you think of Yoshi's, you know, everything's like a kid's drawing and it's cute creatures and all, you know, like it's all quite gentle and quite lighthearted. I mean, it still is, but yeah, comparatively it's like, oh, this is serious now. Like he's massive and he's off in the distance, he's all in shadow and he looks like actually a little bit scary, you know, and all that. So
yeah, he's gonna kill you,
and the guitar kicks in and starts going off. So yeah, I mean, that is pretty common, that actually the guitar as the end. If it's not,
sure.
I guess choir is probably the most common thing. You know, the choral chanting or whatever is probably the most common thing in an end boss thing. But the guitar is pretty common as well. That actually, the showdown at the tower that one mentioned with DK94 has got Game Boy trying to do guitar squealing, which is you know, it's actually remarkably successful. But no, I mean that's a good one. An interesting choice for me has to be Ocarina of Time, because it's very different from what you normally expect from Final Boss. It's very subdued. It's like it's downright sad. The Ganondorf fight. But after, you know, you have the kind of escape sequence, and then, you know, he comes out of the rubble and transforms into Ganon. That fight, which, you know, is, you know, the true, you know, final encounter, it's got the quiet, the kind of like low male quiet, but it's very subdued. It's very sad. And I always remember that because it just sort of, it felt fitted to me because I was just sad that the game was ending. Like, I'd loved it, so I'd look forward to it literally for years. And then you get it, and it is wonderful, and you've loved playing it, and I'd kind of been putting off finishing it to some extent, and had already got a lot of the optional stuff. There really wasn't much left. I didn't have everything. I didn't have all the pieces of heart and that kind of thing, but, you know, this was it. And it was like, it felt right. And it's like, no, I don't want it to end. But, you know, I've got the grim obligation of shoving this sword into Ganon's face and ending it. I always felt like that was kind of an interesting choice, you know, but equally it was a fit. And, you know, I don't know if there's too many other ones I could think of quite like that. Certainly, as was brought up by one, like the Kirby final bosses are a little bit like Yoshi's Island, I guess, in that they just get like way big. Like all of a sudden Kirby's just like, you know, destroying some sort of like cosmic terror from another dimension. And it goes way off. Like all, you know, everything's been like, Kirby music is generally very fun to listen to, but it goes into a whole other scale, a whole other world of just like very big, crazy stuff happening. And there's a kind of, you know, really strong tradition of Kirby final boss music being great and just very big.
Yeah. You mentioned the choir and stuff, being used a lot in final bosses. Well, my second and last pick is, Seventh Dragon 3 Code VFD, which, definitely starts out with like the kind of the ominous, choir chanting. And that goes on for like over a minute. And then eventually, like, this kind of catchy drum beat kicks in with the guitars. And it's like, okay, like, again, it seems to be building up towards something. And then eventually, like, the choir and the guitar and the, you know, and everything just combines. And it's, you know, maybe it's a little bit predictable, but it's effective. Like, it's a fun, track to beat a boss, with. So, I don't know, and kind of motivates you and everything, but I don't really have much more to say about it, except like it's Yuzo Koshiro, and, you know, he's doing his thing, and it's a pretty good last boss track.
Cool. Well, emails again, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. But speaking of music, Greg, it's time for us to wrap the show up. Do you have music for us?
I don't. Well, it wasn't an explicit request or anything, but I thought we'd go with one of WOD's top five. And indeed, it is Showdown at the Tower from Donkey Kong 94, which I believe is actually, it's kind of like, again, it's like the sort of first phase of the final fight against Donkey Kong before, like, he becomes really gigantic and you kind of fight him. It's like the bit before that, but still. If I piqued your interest in what does a Game Boy doing squealing electric guitar sound like, you are about to find out.
Ladies and gentlemen, here it is. Screaming Game Boy guitar. And on that, it's time for us to go. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.